Let's turn in our Bibles to the 22nd chapter of Acts. Paul had a special theme that he liked to dwell upon, and here he's dwelling upon it with great eloquence. Paul was an eloquent preacher, wasn't he? And this was his favorite theme. And I think to every Christian, their favorite theme is what the Lord has done for them. This is what Paul is talking about in this part of the 22nd chapter of Acts, beginning with the 6th verse. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but beginning with the 6th verse, he says, "And it came to pass that as I made my journey and was come nigh unto Damascus about noon, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me. And I fell unto the ground and heard a voice saying unto me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? And I answered, Who art thou, Lord? And he said unto me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. And they that were with me saw indeed the light, and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him that spake to me. And I said, What shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, Arise, and go into Damascus, and there it shall be told thee of all things which are appointed for thee to do. And when I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of them that were with me, I came into Damascus. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good report of all the Jews which dwelt there, came unto me and stood and said unto me, Brother Saul, receive thy sight. The same hour I looked upon him. And he said, The God of our fathers has chosen thee, that thou shouldest know his will, and see that just one, and shouldst hear the voice of his mouth. For thou shalt be his witness unto all men of what thou hast seen and heard. And now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized, and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. And it came to pass that when I was come again to Jerusalem, even while I prayed in the temple, I was in a trance. And I saw him saying unto me, Make haste, and get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, for they will not receive thy testimony concerning me. And so forth. Paul loved to dwell upon this vision that he had of Jesus, this tremendous thing that happened in his life. It changed his whole life, didn't it? It changed the course of his life. Sometimes we're tempted to think that the Lord only does things like this for very special people. But you know, there was another reason. Saul was to be a missionary to the Gentiles. He was a chosen vessel. But there's another reason why the Lord did this for Saul, that we know as Paul. And that was because all other methods had failed. Saul had listened to one of the greatest preachers the world had ever produced. That was Stephen. He listened to him tell that wonderful story of Jesus. Listened to him prove verse by verse all through the Old Testament the story of Jesus. And it had failed to do the job with Paul. He'd even seen Stephen stoned to death and glorifying God, and he had looked upon his face as it had been an angel. And so great had been his prejudice that he had failed to become a follower of Jesus. The Lord doesn't work miracles when his regular channels work. He works miracles in emergencies. Saul was a chosen vessel, and the Lord knew his heart. And it took a face-to-face encounter with Jesus to turn Paul around in his course. He became one of the greatest preachers and the greatest evangelists the world has ever known. But the Lord had to turn him around personally. The Lord does wonderful things in the lives of many people. But it isn't always the chosen vessel that the Lord chooses to do something for. Sometimes it's a humble person that all other means have failed to work in their lives. And tonight, I thought I would relate to you the story of what Jesus has done for me. And the Lord has done some very remarkable things in my life, but it certainly isn't because there's any good in me. On the contrary, I'll have to frankly admit that one reason that he had to do some of these things for me was because I was so stubborn. But I'm so thankful for what he's done for me. And I'd like to begin my story a long ways back. When I was a little boy in Colorado, we lived on the plains of Colorado. close to a little town called Haswell. It's the flattest country that I've ever seen. And it's about the most barren country I've ever seen. You can stand there and look in all directions and you won't see a tree this high. And you can look in all directions and you won't see a hill that high. It's the flattest country I've ever been in. And it's capable of having some terrific storms. And one night in the winter of, I think it was 1931, well, it was one morning. My father taught school 14 miles away in this little town of Haswell, Colorado. And he drove his school bus and picked up a load of children on the way. So he started out and it was snowing when he left. But the wind came up to a very high velocity and the snow increased, and soon the wind blew in the radiator and drowned the motor out so that it wouldn't run. He got out, and in a real blizzard, you can't see your hand that close to your face. You just can't see anything. You can look as hard as you can, and you can't see anything but snow. So my father was a mile and a half from home, and he started walking. The temperature had dropped to below zero, and the wind was close to 80 miles an hour. So he started walking home against this north wind, and he followed the fence with his hand until he came to the gate, and then he went in the gate and just walked north until he bumped into the house and followed the house around till he came to the door. And so his life was spared. And during that storm, there were many people that lost their lives. There was one busload of children that all froze to death in that storm. There was another busload of children that a little boy, 12 years old, saved the lives of several but died himself. It was a very bad experience. That wasn't over 25 or 30 miles from where we were living at the time. This made an impression upon my mind, because the next morning, the house was buried under a snowbank from the barn. At 10 o'clock, the folks were still asleep, and we got up, and it was pitch dark, and went and looked at the windows, and there was snow. Lit a lamp and looked at the windows, and there was snow. We found one little window on the back where the snow was like this, and you could see daylight, and the sun was shining brightly. So we dug our way out. And as that snow melted, it ran in all the cracks, and it was really something. The cattle were in the shed, and the snow drifting back in, they had tramped until they were clear up in the peak and couldn't get out. We had the neighbors had given us a pig, and this pig was in a little house completely packed full of snow. And my father said, "Dead pig." My mother, that was more acquainted with blizzards than my father was, said, "No, he'll be all right." We dug him out, and he just had him a little place thawed in there, and he was nice and warm. Our car was packed completely in the garage. It was an open garage, open on the south, and the snow had packed it completely, clear to the rafters. You couldn't see a thing in there. We had to dig it all out. There were drifts 14 feet high in the yard, so hard that the neighbors came driving their Model T up over the snowbanks, just like that, over to see if we were all right. And as the snow melted, the cattle walked right over these banks. And as the snow melted, they walked right over the fences, and they kept right on walking through fences. We had a herd of cattle you couldn't keep inside of any kind of a fence. They could walk through a fence, and you'd never know the fence was there. We moved to Kansas when I was 8 years old, and these were the days of the Depression. One night, my father had a nice wheat crop coming along, and he needed it very badly. And this wind came up. Some of you perhaps recall the dust storms of the 30s. The wind came up and started the land to blowing. It blew the dust right out and left the wheat, the little stalks of wheat, fallen over and dead. To this day, where our fence used to be, there's a drift of dirt that just covered that fence. There were tumbleweeds, and actually that dust just covered the fences and made a hump of dirt. And my father that night, when it started blowing, he got down on his knees and he prayed that it would stop. And it didn't stop, and he felt that the Lord had turned his back on him, and my father lost his way that night. But the Lord still loved my father, and very soon after that, he did something for us that I shall never forget. We had a nice herd of cattle, about 50 head of cattle, and the pasture started right close to the house and extended for a half mile. A nice sized pasture. The cattle were clear at the other side of the pasture. Our registered prize bull was about a quarter of a mile from the cattle. The cattle were in a herd altogether. It had been dry for months, not a drop of rain, and the pasture was just completely dry. Suddenly there was a little cloud came up. There was a bolt of lightning that hit the ground about halfway between the bull and the cattle and set that pasture on fire. And the wind was blowing toward the house, and that thing just flamed up. Just suddenly the flames had just leaped up. We saw our neighbor that lived the other side of the lightning blast run to his barn, get some equipment to run fight the fire. He couldn't keep up with the fire. He couldn't even catch the fire. It was going so fast. The wind was blowing so hard. Well, we were in the house with Mother, and so my mother prayed, and a little shower came up. Put it out. We didn't have another drop of rain for 3 months, not a drop. And it didn't rain enough to wet the ground. It just put the fire out. That's all it was. There's no question that it was a miracle. So the Lord loved us and was still showing us that he loved us. But I grew up in a home where we were isolated from all other Adventists for long periods of time. We were members of what you call a conference church. And somehow I missed what religion was all about as I grew up. And at the age of 18, they had never entered my mind that there was any hope for me. It seems strange, doesn't it? It's very possible children can grow up right under our feet with completely without hope. No one had ever done any real personal work with me, talked to me about my own soul salvation. And it never had dawned on me that there was any hope for me. I could see hope for others, but not for myself. And I grew up like this. When I was about 18, I came to a little self-supporting school in Tennessee called at that time Fountainhead Academy. And I had been to other schools in the West, but I somehow had not gotten the religion that was there. And the group of boys that I was acquainted with weren't very religious. I was baptized, but I just let a preacher out-talk me. He told me I ought to be baptized, and I didn't know how to say no. And I didn't want to be, but I finally agreed. That was at the age of about 13 or 14. So my baptism was a hindrance to me instead of a help. But then when I was 18, I went to Fountainhead, and as I look back on it, that little school lacked many things, but you know, it seemed like a little heaven on earth to me, because I could see a religion that was a living thing in the lives of the teachers and many of the students. Even though they did a lot of things that they shouldn't, still there were many of those students that were Christians living up to the light that they had. And it seemed to me like a little heaven on earth after some of the things that I had been accustomed to. And while I was there, we had a week of prayer, and Elder Frazee came to Fountainhead and had the week of prayer. And many of the young people gave their hearts to the Lord, and I was one of them. And I tried to live a perfect life. Now, I still needed some personal work. When I found that I hadn't overcome every sin, it discouraged me, and gradually I lost what I had. I decided again that there wasn't much hope for me. I was married, and we lived in various places. We finally found our way to Chattanooga. And during this time, I was not a Christian, and I was miserable. And because I didn't have any real hope, I was restless. I worked night and day, traveled a lot, and we were building up this business here in Chattanooga. My brothers got out of the army and helped me. We had three families to feed on a business that hadn't even gotten off the ground yet. And so I did a lot of hard work and a lot of traveling. And during that time, I was coming back one night from Murphy, North Carolina, and I got into Chattanooga. I just couldn't seem to stay awake. Driving right through town, it was about 1 in the morning, and I couldn't stay awake. I just shaked myself. I knew how dangerous it was driving right through town coming to red lights, but I just couldn't stay awake. Usually I can stay awake quite well, but I couldn't stay awake that night. I finally got through the center of town, and just out a little ways north of town, I found a little wide spot where I could drop off of the pavement, and I stopped my car, laid down, and went to sleep. And it was raining. Now, I don't know how long I slept, but probably not very long. But suddenly I was awakened because right beside me was a car. Just right beside me. I don't know what it was about it that woke me up, but I remember it was an old car, but there were two men in it. And I rolled my window down, and one of those men said, "Now, you're in a dangerous place. Follow me." And I don't know why I would so automatically follow a person in a car, but I started my motor and followed him. And we got to he took me down about four blocks to a place where there was a large parking area of a store, and he drove in there, and I drove up beside him, and he said, "Now, park your car and sleep here. You'll be safe here." So I shut off my switch and shut off my light and turned around. That car had disappeared. And this is when I wasn't even trying to be a Christian. So I'm sure that the Lord was watching over me. I think someday I'll meet an angel in heaven that will tell me about that experience. But this gave me hope. Those years when I was working like this, to me, I look back on them, they were a nightmare. I wasn't doing anything right and doing everything wrong. And gradually, I began to notice that I was tired a lot. But anyone that gets up at 3 in the morning and drives 100 miles and works all day and all night and all the next day and then drives home to get some sleep that next night is naturally tired. And this is the way I did a lot of the time. I didn't think a thing about working all day and all night and half the next day. And so I didn't think too much about it. But gradually, I noticed that I had a cough that developed. And we had a furnace, a coal furnace I was pulling clinkers out of, and the smell of a clinker will just about make anyone cough, and I blamed it on that. Thought that that had something to do with it, and possibly it did. One night when I came in, my conscience constantly was working on me. I came in one night, and just before I went to bed, I just dropped to my knees by the bed just for a moment, and I said, "Lord, help me." And I got back up and promptly forgot it. But the Lord knew it was an honest prayer. And just a few days later, if I remember right, my brothers and I had been working in Dunlap, and we were driving over Signal Mountain on our way home. It was about 11 o'clock at night. I was driving, and just as we came over the top of this mountain and started down the other side, we were on the way up the mountain. I felt a strange feeling in my mouth, and so I stopped the car and got out and spat on the ground, and it was fresh red blood. It was the only hemorrhage I ever had. And when it scared me, I was really, really shaken up by it. I got back in on the other side of the truck and had one of my brothers finish driving home. And I called the doctor that night and talked to him about it. And he said, "Well, probably it's just nasal." But he said, "I want you to come down in the morning and let me examine you." Well, in the morning I got up and I felt all right. I wasn't hemorrhaging anymore, and I knew I ought to go see the doctor, and yet I knew also that I had some appointments. So I drove down the mountain toward Chattanooga and didn't know which way I was going to go as I drove down the mountain. Sometimes I think, well, now I'm going to go on in and be examined, and then I think, well, about all this work, and one moment I'd think one thing and one the other. I finally got to the foot of the mountain where the roads forked and still hadn't made up my mind. And I stopped the truck while I was trying to make up my mind, and I finally just threw caution to the wind and went to work. And I didn't have a physical examination for about a year and a half after that. You know, oftentimes decisions are made just in a moment like that affect us for a lifetime. And this was one of those decisions that needed more attention than I gave it. Young people, especially when they're young, make the biggest decisions of their lives. While they're young, they have less experience to make a decision with, less knowledge to make a decision with, and yet they make those big decisions that alter the whole course of their lives. Is it any wonder that young people need counsel of wise parents and wise friends? And is it any wonder that young people ought to be very careful about their decisions? When you're 60 years old, you won't make decisions that will affect your whole life. A lot of your life is already gone. But when you're 16, you can make decisions that absolutely change your life, the whole course of your life. And I would urge every young person here to value the counsel of those older than they are. Really value it. Because people that are giving you counsel aren't always just trying to keep you from having a good time. They're trying to keep you out of trouble. Well, I made this decision and went on to work. Worked for a year and a half. Well, during that year and a half, if I hadn't had a tremendous constitution, I certainly couldn't have lasted that long. Finally, I realized that I didn't really tell anybody much about how I felt, but I finally realized I had to get out of that program. And a friend of mine came over that was operating Lawrenceburg Sanitarium and asked me to come over and do their lab and x-ray work and help with a male patient. So I agreed to. And it was quite a blow to my brothers. They felt they needed me. But I knew that I had to do something. So I went over there. We moved over there. And the day after I got there, there was another boy there who was working on the x-ray, and he and I were getting acquainted with it together. He didn't know it very well. And so I took his chest x-ray, and he took mine. And I looked at that x-ray. And I'm not any doctor, and I don't read x-rays, but that x-ray scared me badly, just looking at it. I've never seen such a cloudy-looking chest film in all my life. But I went home and didn't think much more about it. The next morning, there was a knock on my door, and the hospital administrator came in. He said, "Warren, I want to talk to you." He said, "The doctor came and was looking through those x-rays, and he looked at your x-ray, and he says you have TB, and he thinks you have a pretty bad case of TB. Well, that was a jolt. You're never ready for something like that. There's lots of things need done. There's debts need paid and unfinished business everywhere. You're never ready for a blow like that. I said, "Well, I'll try to get things in order." The idea was I'd try to get my house in order so I go to bed. He said, "No, you go to bed right now." Well, I don't know. I just wasn't prepared to go to bed right then. But that's what I did. And I hadn't shed a tear, I don't think, since I was 11 years old. But I just laid down across the bed and shed some tears that day. Well, that was the beginning of the Lord's answering that prayer of mine. When I said, "Lord, help me," I didn't think about the methods he might use to help me. But I found myself with a bad case of TB. In fact, I got into the TB hospital, and I took my x-ray along. The average doctor is not a specialist in reading x-rays. Especially TB x-rays. It takes a person with some special training to read those x-rays. So this Dr. Harrison that was at the TB hospital, he held that x-ray up to the sun and looked at it. And he said to my wife, he says, "Can't you drive?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, why aren't you doing it?" I said, "This boy has no business driving." And I found out that I had TB in every square inch of both lungs. There wasn't a clear spot in either lung. I had a large cavity behind my clavicle on my right side, on this side here, a large cavity about so big around right here, and just scattered infiltration throughout both lungs. Well, it was a bad case of TB. I asked him, I said, "How long do you think it'll take me to get well?" He said, "Oh, probably a year." Well, I'll just have to forgive him for telling a point-blank lie, because he knew. He's bound to have known a year wouldn't even touch a case of TB like that. They tried a lot of things on me in the hospital, and nothing seemed to work. They decided to collapse the worst lung with what they called a pneumothorax. They would pump air between the lung and the chest cavity, which would flatten the lung out and give it a chance to rest. But it wouldn't work because I had adhesions, places eaten through the pleural lining that had adhered to the chest cavity. So that wouldn't work. And they tried, that was before the days of a lot of TB drugs, so all I did was lie in bed for 7 months there. Well, during that time, I had all kinds of problems, financial problems, every other kind of problem, but I still hadn't given my heart to the Lord. There are many things about a story like this you can't tell, because there's much that involves many people. But things got worse and worse until I was just at my wit's end to know what to do. There I was in the hospital and couldn't do anything. And finally, I felt that my home was falling apart, and that was the last straw. And I finally rolled over in that hospital bed and gave my heart to the Lord. But what a jolt it took. It's amazing how some people can be so stubborn and hold out so long. Well, you know, the Lord did wonderful things for me that day. I still had all my problems, but I had a friend. And there's nothing like having a real friend when you're really needing help. And there's no friend like the Lord. And he came very near to me. I had a wonderful experience with him that day. And I started reading Conflict series through. I'd never read any of these books before. The Lord certainly blessed my eyes. I read many days, 8 hours straight. And with a fresh conversion, my mind could just soak things up. And it just did. The time I spent in the TV hospital was the time I devoured the books. I read many of Sister White's books. I had a little bit of money that we had saved for special purposes, and Loretta brought me all of the Spirit of Prophecy books, and I read many of them. And I wouldn't take anything for the time the Lord gave me to read, to study my Bible. I read the Bible through a couple of times. I knew nothing about the Bible before that. So the Lord heard my prayer that night when I said, "Lord, help me." He took me right at my word, and He helped me. I wouldn't take anything for that experience I had with the Lord. I wouldn't take anything for what he put me through to give me the experience. And I've never gotten over it. I mean, I still don't have lung capacity. I'm still not like I was before. But I wouldn't take anything for the experience, because it was a lifesaver to me. The Lord loves every person here. If there's anyone here that hasn't given their heart to the Lord, don't make it so hard for the Lord. He certainly doesn't like to put a person through an experience like that. He doesn't like to really chastise people. But He's told us that if He loves us, He'll chastise us if we need it. But a lot of the time, we wouldn't have to go through experiences like this. The Lord doesn't enjoy it, does He? Don't make the Lord do this to you. Make it a lot easier for Him. Give your heart to Him because you love Him, because you realize how much He's done for you. But I'm thankful that the Lord will do things like this for you if you need it. Isn't it wonderful to know that He'll do everything in His power to save us, even to doing things like this to us? So I'm very thankful for what the Lord has done for me. Well, I was sent home from the hospital after I'd been there 7 months, because they said there wasn't anything they could do for me. All I could do was just go home for bed rest. Well, there were so many problems, financial and otherwise. And I know it seems insane, and worse than foolish, it just seems insane what I did. But I got up and went back to work. But the Lord, as I look back on it, I believe if I had to do it again, I'd do it all over again. The problems were so great. And I felt the nearness of the Lord. I felt that I was doing the right thing. And I was enjoying a good Christian experience, and the Lord was near to me. I believe I was ready to go. I knew I was killing myself. I had no hope in my mind that I would live through the experience. But I kept right on going. And I worked until it came to the point one day I was out at work, and I just couldn't do it any longer. I was 60 miles from home, and I almost couldn't get home. So I drove home and I went to bed. And I thought, well, now I'll get better. And I asked to be anointed. So a wonderful Adventist evangelist by the name of Elder Veach came with our local minister to anoint me. And I appreciated the things he said. He said, "Warren, we may be anointing you for an instant recovery or a slow recovery or for your death." I appreciated that. And I felt that the Lord was very near to us that day. I was anointed, and 3 days later, I had a terrible back set. I really lost a lot of ground. We were living in my mother's little house at that time. She let us live there during this period, and Loretta was working. We had a little didn't have any indoor facilities, had a little outdoor outhouse. Used to go out there and it got so I could hardly get back. It was just so much effort. It was only 100 feet away, I guess, a couple hundred maybe. So finally I couldn't do that any longer. Finally I got out of bed and couldn't stand up any longer. So I had to stay in bed. Then it got to the point where I couldn't roll over without help. I was running a temperature of about 104 every day, having terrific sweat. They'd come in at night. We sent for my mother, and she was staying with us at that time. 3 or 4 times during the night and changed my linen and just wring water out of it. You could just hold it up and just turn it and wring water out of it. And I lost weight until I weighed, last time I was able to stand on the scales without help, I weighed 98 pounds. I lost a lot of weight after that. I got so I could wrap my fingers around my ankle and cross them over. My ankles were so small. And I hadn't looked in a mirror for months. Somebody brought me a mirror one day, and I looked in that mirror and saw that little shriveled up, wrinkled up little old man, and I hardly knew who it was. I just had lost so many pounds, and I rapidly got worse, and my wife asked the doctor what was going to happen, and he said, well, it would just be a matter of time. So I was out on this, I read the Spirit of Prophecy and tried to do everything it said. I think I went a little bit to the extreme part of the time, but the Lord knows that I was trying to be honest, that I was honest in heart about it, and I really tried to do everything exactly right. So I was sleeping out on a porch, an open porch where I get plenty of fresh air, and we were out in the country. I had visitors there one day, and I was talking to them, and I suddenly had this pain develop in my chest over here. And I thought, well, I won't say anything about it. But it got so bad, so rapidly, that I lost consciousness of everything about me, and all I remember is just screaming as hard as I could scream until all at once it was over. And when it was over, I couldn't breathe. And so my mother thought I was dying, and I thought so too. My mother went into her room and got her Bible and opened it up and fell down on her knees by the side of her bed to offer prayer, and her eyes fell upon a verse, 1 Peter 5, verse 10. There's a wonderful promise. Some of you may need it someday. It says, but the God of all grace, who hath called us unto his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after that ye have suffered a while, make you perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. This is the text that her eyes fell upon. She came back in and told me, she said, I'm sure you're going to get well. That took faith right then. And I believed at that time that the Lord would do this for her. And there were times when my faith certainly faltered after that, but I just trusted the Lord. Well, my brother-in-law was there, and he went to get me some oxygen. I coughed up, I guess, 2 teacups full of green, thick pus. What had happened to me? This left lung had collapsed spontaneously. It had finally become so eaten up that there wasn't anything left of it. And it had collapsed and left me with all of this pus to get up while I was trying to breathe with this other lung that was also about gone. But he brought me some oxygen, and I took oxygen for 8 months. And it was certainly a welcome thing to be able to breathe oxygen. You don't have to breathe nearly as hard. But after I had this collapse, this spontaneous collapse, then my temperatures went down. In fact, my temperature dropped clear down to 97 from about 104. And I slept for a couple of days almost constantly. And I began improving after this experience. But Loretta asked the doctor what would happen to me. He said, well, it'll just be a matter of time. This lung that he's using is in such bad shape that it will just finally give up. And he didn't hold out any hope for her that I would get well. I got into the TB hospital in Nashville, and it was quite, I won't go into the details of how how the Lord arranged it. Well, maybe I should go into the detail, just briefly. She went down to the, my folks and Loretta went down to the, health department and asked them how long it would be before I could get in. They said, well, at least 6 months. And so they came back and told me, and I said, well, go see Dr. Gass. He was the head of the whole department in Tennessee, of the whole TB department, and I had met him and gotten well acquainted with him when I'd been in the hospital before. So she went to see him, and she saw him walking across the lawn and recognized him. And she spoke to him and asked him if he remembered me, and he said, yes, how's Warren? So she told him, and he was very much concerned. So he went in, he said, let me go check. So he went in and checked to see how soon he could get me in, and how soon was it? 5 days instead of 6 months. So, but before I got in the TB hospital, there's one experience that I want to tell you about. I was lying there on that sleeping porch after my lung had collapsed, and my brother, that oxygen bill went up and up and up. I was using a tank of that oxygen every day, and it was the price, the cost was going up fast, and the bill was mounting. I was using $49 worth of oxygen a week. Loretta was making $35 a week on her job. So it doesn't take a mathematician to figure out that was certainly a losing game. That didn't include any food to eat or anything like that. So I'd lie there and worry about that. I shouldn't have been worrying, but I was, about that oxygen bill. It looked as though I was going to die and leave her with about a $1,000 oxygen bill to pay off. And I dreaded to see that happen. So one day I was there, my brother and I owned some property here on Signal Mountain. And I had thought, years before, I had promised it to the Lord. I said, Lord, if that property ever sells, the money's yours. And then I just dismissed it and left it that way. Well, my brother came to see me one day from Chattanooga, and he said, I have good news for you. Sold that property on Signal Mountain. I said, really? My oxygen bill at that time was approximately $265, more or less. And my share of this property was about the same amount of money, just about enough to pay off that oxygen bill. But I'd promised that money to the Lord. Well, I didn't tell anybody about what I was thinking, but I wrestled with that all day long. The devil would tell me, well, now, who needs it worse than you do? To pay off this oxygen bill, it isn't selfish, you're doing it for your wife's sake. So I wrestled with that all day long, but the Lord would tell me, no, you promised it to me. Finally, along toward evening, I just offered up a prayer, and I said, now, Lord, it isn't mine, and I'm not going to use it. It's yours. And so I dismissed the thing from my mind. And the Lord honors us when we exercise real faith. I wish always I had exercised that much faith. But I just promised him that it was his, and I wouldn't use it no matter what happened. Well, a week later, my father came from Kansas to see me. Everyone was coming to see me because they didn't think they'd see me very many more times. He came to see me, and he brought me a check from my grandfather. Now, my grandfather was a very wealthy farmer. To my knowledge, he'd never given anybody anything much. He believed in keeping his money. But he had sold a load of wheat one day. He was selling his wheat, sent a truckload of wheat in, and he sent the check down to me by my father. That check was $265. And so it was just enough to pay off the oxygen bill. But then my father went over and paid the oxygen bill off himself. So within a week from the time I exercised that faith and trust in the Lord paid my oxygen bill and gave me double my money. The Lord's a good paymaster, isn't he? You can't overpay him. Some people think they can't afford to pay tithe. That's right. If you don't pay tithe, you can't afford to pay tithe. You can't afford not to. But if you don't pay tithe, pretty soon you're in such bad shape financially that you certainly can't afford to pay tithe. Way back before this, at the time I first gave my heart to the Lord, I hadn't paid tithe for a long time. And so I figured it all up, sold my car, and paid my tithe, the back tithe. And the Lord has has really blessed me with a few things that I have done because I've been faithful in seeing to it my tithe was paid. We don't need to worry about giving the Lord His own. If we'll faithfully do it from a loving heart, He'll give us more than we can ever get any other way. Any money that we keep that know about tithing, any money that we keep that belongs to the Lord is money that has a curse on it, a real curse on it. It'll be money you'll wish time and again you never had. I know a party that has never paid tithe, a member of our church, and that today, if he were to try to pay back his back tithe, it would take everything he has. He's a man in probably 55 years old. Probably if he sold everything he had, he couldn't pay his back tithe. There's only one time to pay tithe, and that is its due, isn't it? It isn't our money. And the Lord will really honor a person for exercising honesty, being honest with him. He told the Jews that they'd robbed him. They said, "Wherein have we robbed thee?" He said, "In tithes and offering." He said, "Therefore ye are cursed with a curse." He said, "Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord, if I will not open the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing that there won't be room enough to receive it." It's a promise. If anybody hasn't done this, just try the Lord out. It works. He's faithful. You may not be able to keep very good books, but the Lord keeps excellent books, right down to the penny. And if you're honest with Him, He'll certainly repay. So I got in the hospital. And it was interesting how I got to the hospital. When I was checked in, there was a nurse there that asked me what church, she was taking my history and asked me what church I belonged to. She was writing these things down. When I told her, she said, "Well, just a minute." And she went running down the hall. I could hear her go. In a little bit, she came back with a doctor. Dr. Acock. And he checked me in and was my doctor. So after she got this settled, she told me, she said, "Now this man's sympathetic with Seventh-day Adventists." This lady had had some contact with Seventh-day Adventists, and so she knew that I would need a doctor that was sympathetic toward Adventists. I found out afterward that the other doctors would tell you, if you don't eat pork or meat, you deserve to die. This was the attitude they had toward them, and I didn't know this. Only the Lord could have arranged it. So this doctor was one of the outstanding people that I've ever known. He was so hard on drugs that you could hardly get a aspirin out of him. He didn't believe in them. He'd been in the army for years. And one time I had a little fungus on my finger, and I said, "I need something for this fungus." He said, "Stick it under the hot water faucet. That'll kill it quicker than any medicine you can put on it. It'll work. But believe you me, you have to let it run hot. But it'll certainly kill a fungus." And he had all kinds of things that he knew like that, gems of wisdom that he'd picked up here and there. Well, I know that this is providential because he put on my orders vegetarian diet. And this was certainly eased my problems in that hospital a whole lot. By spells, I didn't get a true vegetarian diet, but it wasn't his fault. One night, they brought us each an apple, one evening for supper, brought us each an apple and a bacon, a ham sandwich. And I never, ever once complained about my food. I ate what I could and left the rest. And I tried to... Some of those nurses had a pretty bad opinion of Adventists because they'd had some in there that complained about all food. I was determined not to. Well, this nurse came in that had admitted me just about the time I got that tray. And she says, "What'd they bring you a tray like this for?" She says, "Here, give me that." So she took it and went down to the diet kitchen, and she brought me back ice cream and cake and all kinds of things. Well, there was one man there in the hospital that had been there 27 years, and he was very antagonistic against Seventh-day Adventists. He had no use for it. He called me a bean eater, and he'd been sick for 27 years with TB and been there 27 years. He was in bad shape. But he happened to come hobbling down the hall to see me just at the time I got this tray. And he had his ham sandwich and his apple. And he said, "Well, it looks like I'm going to have to join the Seventh-day Adventist Church to get anything to eat around here." But I had many good experiences in the hospital, many opportunities to witness. There was a young man came in one day, and I had at these times in there with an article on the Sabbath that was most powerfully, caustically written article I've ever read on the subject. And what should this boy do but pick this up and start reading this article? And I tried to get him stopped. I'd rather have given it to him in an easier manner. He read it through and believed every word of it. He said, "Can I borrow this?" He went down the halls doing his missionary work with this magazine. But I had many good experiences. There were many of those fellows that had never owned a Bible and never had looked inside of a Bible. There was one man in particular that told me that all he'd ever done was make whiskey. Carried 100-pound sacks of sugar over the mountain and made whiskey in a still back in the country. And I asked him, he came in to see me. I wasn't able to get out of bed. He came in to see me one day, and I started talking to him about the Bible. And I said, "Do you have a Bible?" "No," he said, "I never read one." So I had Loretta bring him one. And do you know, I never saw that man after that when he wasn't reading that Bible. Later, as I got better, I'd walk past his room, and he was always reading that Bible. He read that Bible constantly. And because, for some reason, he had no relatives anywhere, and because his time ran out and he had to leave, and he wasn't well, Tennessee had so many hospital beds full that they could only give you so much time in the hospital bed, and then you had to leave. And he wasn't well, so he didn't know anything else to do, so he went back to making whiskey, carrying those 100-pound sacks of sugar over them. And he started going down rapidly, and somebody said, "You ought to be in Arizona." So he hitchhiked to Arizona, and he couldn't get a ride one day, and one day the highway patrol picked him up. He passed out on the highway. And they sent him back to Tennessee, and before I left the hospital, he was back in. And he just looked like death itself. I walked by his room one day, and I hardly recognized him. I didn't know he was back. You know what he was doing? Reading that same Bible, and it was just battered and beat. He'd had it all the way to Arizona. He'd had it over at his whiskey still and everywhere else reading that Bible. And I wouldn't have been surprised if I'll see that man in the kingdom. He was an honest heart. He was doing the best he knew how to do. If the Lord, you know, we think about the woman of Samaria. The scribes and Pharisees looked like good material for Jesus to work with, didn't they? What did the woman of Samaria look like? She had five husbands and was living with a man that wasn't her husband. Did she look like much of a prospect for the kingdom? And yet Jesus' disciples were looking forward into the future into doing a great work, and she was ready to do missionary work right then. And people that look the worst to us are actually, in the Lord's sight, farther advanced than we are, closer to Him than we are. We'd do a poor job of numbering Israel, wouldn't we? When I first got in the hospital, I took oxygen then for, all told, 8 months. They put me in a little room by myself, and there were six little rooms lined up on one side of the hall where they put the critical cases. And I stayed there long enough to see all five of those other fellows die and carried out. One of them that used to walk in to see me wasn't nearly as sick as I was, died. I saw men come in there that didn't look too sick, that didn't ever live through it. But the Lord, little by little, I could tell that I was getting better. I could turn that oxygen down a little bit. So I kept turning it down. The doctor says, "You don't need that oxygen anymore." I said, "Yes, I do." Because when I quit using it, I would cough. I knew that was hurting my lungs. So I kept turning it down. He didn't think I'd ever get off of it because he said, "Most people never get off of oxygen." But I finally one day turned it off, and that was a glad day. I told him, "I'm through with it now. I don't need it anymore." Now I said, "What do you propose to do?" He said, "Well, I hope we can get you ready for surgery." He said, this left lung is a little knot about so big around. There's that big vacuum in there." And he says, "Nature abhors a vacuum. Sooner or later, you'll be in serious trouble if we don't do surgery on that left side." And I said, "Well, what about the right side?" "He's perfectly clear. Good shape. All healed up." And it was the side that had the big cavity behind the clavicle. And it had TB all through it. But he said, "It's all well." So they started getting me ready for surgery, trying to get me ready for surgery. First thing I had to do was learn to walk again. I hadn't stepped on the floor for a long time. So So I decided, well, it was time I start. He said, start walking. Well, I sat up. I was so dizzy. I hadn't been in an upright position for probably 9-10 months. I was so dizzy, I just was nauseated. But I did it every day for a while and got used to it, and was sitting up one day reading my books, and my back popped, and I sprained my back. So I had to lie down for 2 or 3 days. But I got where I could sit up, so I decided to get brave and see if I could stand up. So I got off this high hospital bed and reached down to get something I had dropped. And, you know, I had to just strain and pull for all I was worth to get back up on that bed. Lay there and just puffed and panted for a long time. Finally, I got so I could walk around the bed by hanging onto the bed, and got brave one day and walked down to the bathroom. It was probably as far as from here to Brother Callahan back there. And I thought I never would get back. It was the longest walk I ever took. But little by little, I got so I could walk up and down those halls and got to feeling real good. And finally was able to take surgery and had that left lung removed. And then 5 weeks later, they sent me home. The brother said she was felt like a lady with a new baby. She didn't know what in the world to do with me. She thought I was really fragile, and I guess I was. But I was of good courage because the Lord had done so much for me. When the Lord's your friend, what do you have to worry about? I see gloomy Christians, and I just can't figure it out. We ought to be the happiest people in the world. If you've never gone through an experience like that, and you're gloomy today, what would you be like if you had something really to worry about? But the Lord had really given me an experience, and I was full of courage every day, all through it. And I know the courage that I had, that He had given me, and the faith that I had, that He had given me, helped me tremendously in getting well. Our state of mind has a lot to do with whether we get well or not. The people in the community up at Highland Academy were good to me. They did many things to help us. I've never ceased to be thankful for all the good friends that I had during that time. And I thank the Lord. There are many other things I could tell you. I see the time's all gone, more than gone. But I'm thankful for every trial the Lord has given me. The Lord had to teach me some lessons the hard way. He had to teach me that the trinkets of this earth are worth nothing, that money is worthless, that the friends of this world are not stable or dependable, that only as we trust in Him are we really happy. That's the only joy there is in the world.
We hope your heart has been stirred by this powerful presentation by the late W.D. Frazee, co-founder of Wildwood Sanitarium and author of Ransom and Reunion and Another Ark to Build. Many of his classic audio recordings are available online as free downloads at www.wdfsermons.org. A new free download is added to the list monthly. There are also dozens of sermon series available on such vital topics as The Sanctuary, Righteousness by Faith, Courtship, Marriage and Family, Leadership and Management, Last Day Events, How They Will Transpire and the Preparation We Need to Be Ready for Them, and much, much more. Some of our most popular titles are Preparing for Marriage, a very practical yet thorough instruction about how to prepare for courtship and marriage in a way that's not only proper, but that best pleases the Lord. Husbands and Wives is an 8-part series that shows how a godly marriage may become the most effective means of explaining the mystery of godliness. Crisis at the Close reveals a striking parallel between the closing scenes of the life of Christ and the experience of the 144,000. Holy Spirit in the Sanctuary shows the connection of Christ's closing work for us in the sanctuary above and the Holy Spirit's work for us in the body temple. These are just a few of the hundreds and hundreds of powerful messages that are speaking now with greater force and to broader audiences than when Elder Frazee was alive. You can view our current complete listing of the sermons we have available on our website. You can order our sermons and books from the internet, or you can call in your orders. If you don't have access to the internet, you may call to request our free catalog. We hope you'll find each message to be a great blessing to you personally and to others as you share them with family, friends, neighbors, and co-workers. To place your orders, visit our website at www.wdfsermons.org. That's wdfsermons.org. Or call us at 706-820-9755. That's 706-820-9755. May God richly bless you as fellow workers with Him, we labor together to make ready a people prepared for the Lord.